And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is Michael Lind. He says U.S. politics is about to change big time. He is a fellow at the nonpartisan think tank New America in Washington, D.C., the author of Land of Promise, an Economic History of the United States. And he recently wrote an article titled This is What the Future of American Politics Looks Like, which appeared in Politico. It caught my eye. He's also a contributing editor at Politico. Michael Lind, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Very much enjoy your writing in Politico and otherwise. Let's talk specifically about this most recent article. You write that a new era is beginning, but not the way most people think. Though this election feels like the beginning of a partisan realignment, you write, it's actually the end of one. Explain.
Well, the partisan realignment took place between the 1960s, the civil rights and cultural revolutions of the 60s, and it was pretty much complete by the turn of the century. By the partisan realignment, I mean the breakup of the old Eisenhower-Rockefeller Republican Party and the old Roosevelt, you know, Kennedy-Johnson Democratic Party, and their transfer of voters with a lot of the fiscally moderate, socially liberal people in the North in particular, who used to be moderate Republicans, are now the part of the Democratic base, and blue-collar whites in the South, who historically were the base of the Democratic Party, are now the base of the Republican Party. So the last couple of elections, you've pretty much seen these new coalitions have been very stable. The big news in this election is the policy realignment. That is, there's been a gap between the existing coalitions of the two parties as they now exist and their ideologies or their party programs, mm-hmm. which were formulated in the 1980s and 1990s. And I think particularly with Trump, but to a lesser extent with Sanders, you see an attempt to move the party policy towards the values of the actually existing present-day voter base of each party.
Mm-hmm. And in your story, you use the word fossil. You write about let's take the Democratic primary. Pundits who focused on the clash between Sanders and Clinton, you write, missed the story. You said there was something very telling about the quick failure of Jim Webb.
Well, I don't mean calling him a fossil disrespectfully, but he represents the old New Deal coalition between Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson. And this was, you know, largely a working class white, disproportionately Southern coalition. And it plays practically no role at this point in the Democratic Party, which is largely a coalition of Northern and urban upscale whites with African Americans and Latinos. It's really a new party mm-hmm. under the same name. And the same is actually, there's more continuity demographically on the Republican side, because the Republicans is a coalition of white Southerners and what used to be called white ethnics, that is working class whites, often of Catholic religion in the Northeast. That was the old Jacksonian Democratic Party. That was the Democratic Party between Andrew Jackson and Lyndon Johnson. So in a sense, the parties have exchanged labels. Yeah. With the party of Lincoln is now the party of Andrew Jackson, and what used to be the party of FDR is you know, much more like the party of Rockefeller.
And you say seeing it through this lens leads you to the explanation of why Jeb Bush failed. He represented also this outdated GOP.
Yeah, as recently as the 1980s and 1990s, the GOP was, you know, largely a kind of upscale, upper middle class, you know, a business party. And most CEOs still lean Republican, so I don't want to exaggerate. But it's much more of a working class blue collar party now than it ever was before. And there's just a tension between the inherited agenda of the Republican elites, which is all about slashing Social Security, cutting back on Medicare, lowering taxes on the rich, and the actual interests of the blue-collar, white working-class Republican base. And Trump has exploited that disconnect. He was the only one of these more than a dozen Republican presidential candidates who said he would not cut Social Security and would leave Medicare alone. And Social Security and Medicare are very popular with white working class Republicans. Their views on immigration restriction and on trade protectionism also put the Republican working class base at odds with the so-called country club Republicans, you know, who continue to shape the platform. So, you know, my prediction is that Trump is just the beginning, and there will be a gradual adjustment of Republican policies to what the Republican voters of the 21st century actually want. And it's not the sort of business-oriented small government party that it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Michael Lind is my guest this half hour. He says U.S. politics are changing very quickly and in a very big way. He's a fellow at the nonpartisan think tank New America in Washington. Join our conversation. Your questions about the future of the U.S. political system as we cast our eyes a decade or two into the future, into the 2020s and 2030s, talking about, I guess, a realignment. Michael's been terming it the end of an alignment that took place, as he explained, during the 1960s. 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Going back to your point about Social Security being very popular also among Republicans, working class Republicans, as it is among working class Democrats. How does that not translate to we see this great partisan divide in universal health care or Obamacare?
Well, Obamacare was and is a means-tested program. So for the poor, you have an expansion of Medicaid. And then for people up to a certain amount of income, you have sliding scales of subsidies. And historically, working-class Americans, who used to be mostly Democratic, have been very suspicious of or hostile to means-tested programs for the poor only, and very supportive of universal programs like Social Security and Medicare, which benefit them and their families. And one can denounce this as selfish, but you know that's true not only here but in other democracies. Universal programs that benefit everyone tend to be have more public support than means-tested programs limited to the poor. Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, was not designed as a universal program. It is a welfare program that is means-tested. And so it's not surprising at all, and it's not inconsistent, that people who support Medicare, which is a universal program which benefits everyone, should oppose the expansion of Medicaid if they and their families make too much money to qualify for it.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the role of the culture war here. You say that is fading, the cultural war, cultural issues largely to do with sex, gender, and so forth, and that will be eclipsed by something called the border war.
Yes, if you look at religiosity, the religious right was very powerful in the late 20th century, to the extent that even Democrats like Bill Clinton had to try to accommodate it to some degree. But among younger Americans, religious belief is dropping very rapidly. And if the trends continue, the U.S. will be as relatively secular as Western Europe is in another generation or two. And just as in Western Europe, as these religious issues have declined, issues of national identity have risen. And that's largely a result of demographic factors. Both in Western Europe and in the U.S., you have a very low fertility native population, combined with a large, high amount of immigration. It's from different sources. It's more from the North America in the U.S. case, and more from North Africa and the Middle East in the European case. But wherever you have a shrinking native population and a rising immigrant population, you're going to tend to get a nativist backlash. And so I argue that that kind of politics over immigration as the central issue is eclipsing the old culture war issues, which revolve around sex and reproduction from a religious perspective.
And so you say that there is this clash between, as you call them, sort of nationalists, mostly on the right, and what you call multicultural globalists on the left. And this is just the beginning of this clash.
Yes, that's right. And you see it on both sides of the Atlantic. So it's represented by Trump here. You have national populist figures like Nigel Farage in Britain, Marine Le Pen in France, and others. Now, they're usually called the far right, which is somewhat misleading, because on economic issues, they tend to be on the far left. They tend to be the left of the so-called progressives. So what has happened is progressives who, when they were dominated by native working-class labor unions, historically in the U.S. opposed high immigration because it lowers wages and creates more competition for native workers. The media has now defined progressive to mean what was actually the old right-wing libertarian approach of having open borders and of not punishing illegal immigrants or deporting them in any way, which was the policy of the Wall Street Journal libertarians in the 1980s. So when we throw these terms around like far right, we should bear in mind that most of these national populists in Europe and America, when it comes to the welfare state, you know, actually tend to be to the left of people like Hillary Clinton and Tony Blair.
Mm. Michael Lind is with us. He is a fellow at New America, a think tank in Washington. Let's go to our phones. Nick is with us in Ames. Nick dialed 1-866-780-9100. Nick, what does this stir in your head?
Well, I came into the conversation a little bit late, and thank you for taking on my phone call. But so I fall in that millennial category, and my biggest curiosity is really it's hard, as most millennials say, to fall in that conservative camp because ideologically it has such that religious factor to it. But I'm really curious, as we talked earlier, two decades from now, as people with my generation, that I wouldn't consider myself a libertarian, but the social issue reforms, they're going to happen, they're moving forward, but I find myself very much wanting the balanced budget concept and being very financially conservative. And so I'm curious about how the Republican Party and how that merge, and maybe it was addressed earlier, but how does that merge happen as a younger population that doesn't care so much about social reform? We're there already, to put it in terms of transgender, gay rights issues. Let's step past that. Let's look at solving policy issues. And how does that kind of transform, particularly the Republican Party, in your opinion, Michael, if I can ask?
Thank you, Nick and Ames.
Certainly. I think if I'm correct, and the Republicans become more populist, then people who are fiscal conservatives and favor balanced budgets and small government and less spending may actually find themselves more at home in the Democratic Party, which I predict will continue to move to the right on economics, even if it claims to be progressive on things like transgender issues and race and gender equity in general. But if the Republicans really do become a white working class populist party, then you're probably going to see deficit spending, which was characteristic of the New Dealers when they were the white working class party, and it's been associated with the supply side wing of the Republicans. And you're probably going to see the preservation or expansion of the welfare state, at least to the extent that it benefits native working class, not necessarily immigrants or poor people.
Mm-hmm.
So if you really want small government, and at the same time, I think what you see on the center left, there is a movement away from the historic New Deal commitment to universal social programs to more targeted means-tested programs. And this is justified on the theory that if you have means-tested programs, then you have more money to target on the poor people who need it the most, rather than spreading, too little peanut butter over the whole toast.
Right.
So I think the parties are in some ways, it seems kind of ironic, but certainly if you look at free trade and free immigration, those used to be right-wing policies. Right now they're supported by younger Democrats more than by younger Republicans.
So you say if the Republican Party becomes more populist, what will determine that? Is that all if whether Trump wins or loses?
No, this is a long-term process, and it's been going on ever since 1972, when Richard Nixon won over a lot of the populist followers of George McGovern, who was a segregationist, very right-wing socially, but actually rather left-wing economically. The thing is, from Nixon to the present, essentially the business class Republicans have been able to count on these populist Republican voters to support them, even though they're not delivering what the Republican voters actually want, at least the working class Republican voters. And Trump is not the first manifestation of this by any means. You may recall that in his second term, President George W. Bush tried to partly privatize Social Security. That was so unpopular among Republican voters that it never even was brought to a vote, even though the Republicans controlled both houses of Congress. And you may remember that House Minority Leader, Majority Leader Cantor was recently defeated in 2014 by an unknown congressman named David Brat, an unknown candidate.
He was primaried, yes.
Yeah, in the primary, and on the issue of immigration, which business class Republicans tend to want more immigration. It's more labor, keeps wages down, and the working class Republicans tend to oppose it for a mix of ethnic reasons and fears of competition.
So what do you say?
So Trump is, if Trump did not exist, someone else would have exploited this.
Mm-hmm. We have about 5 minutes left, Michael Lind. Let's look. What are then the most significant or lasting implications in the short term of either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton winning the White House?
Well, I think if Hillary Clinton wins, you're going to have a civil war within the Republican Party between the older, more free market-oriented establishment and this kind of blue-collar populism. And the establishment might, you know, be able to regain power for a cycle or two, but I think in the long run, they're going to lose. I think if Hillary Clinton wins by attracting many libertarian, free market-oriented, anti-populist Republicans, then that will cement the shift of the Democratic Party, which has been underway for a generation or so, away from New Deal-type social democracy of the Bernie Sanders sort towards what's called neoliberal or more market-oriented, more business-friendly policies. So I think the results of a defeat will be more dramatic in the Republican Party, defeat of Trump. But, you know, they could also accelerate the shift of some elite Republicans into the Democratic Party camp. Now, if Trump wins, all bets are off, and that will have to be another discussion someday.
Mm-hmm. All bets are off. Give us it in a nutshell, because we have an unpredictable person.
Well, no, in practice, look, Trump is not Hitler or Mussolini. He's Andy Jackson or William Jennings Bryan. He's very American-type populist. You know, so we don't need to worry about dictatorship. And if anything, I think if he did get elected, he'd be an extremely weak, probably one-term president, because when you have these celebrity outsiders like Jesse Ventura in Minnesota and Arnold Schwarzenegger in California, they tend not to accomplish very much because they don't have the support of the party they nominally belong to if they're not independents like Ventura. So I think he would be a weak Carter-like president. He would not be a tyrannical dictator.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm in the minority in much of the media in thinking this.
Mm-hmm. So in closing, of these two coalitions, which you see going on to the 2020s, onto the 2030s, if what you say is correct, which is likely to prevail most of the time, as you also ask in your article?
Well, I think it depends on which way Latino voters and their descendants go electorally. If they form a solid, permanent Democratic voting bloc, then the growth of Latino numbers in the electorate would provide a permanent Democratic majority. On the other hand, if they are sort of like the so-called white ethnics of the Northeast, who were Roosevelt Democrats, but then they defected and supported Reagan and the Republicans in the last part of the 20th century, that's the question. I do think it's clear that for the Republicans to seem anti-Latino or anti-Hispanic really is fatal to them, because not in this particular election or even in the next, because the Latino vote's concentrated in a few states. They're not really a swing vote. But in the long term, what happens with Latinos, who are the only group of the population who are really growing as a share of the population, I think that will determine the fate of the party system.
We have a minute or so left. Your thoughts quickly on how the Supreme Court controversy over filling that ninth vacant seat will play out in the context you've described?
I'm not sure it makes that much of a difference in the sense that this is very big for politically aware voters. But I don't think most people cast their ballots on the basis of, you know, worried about who's going to fill a Supreme Court seat.
Mm-hmm.
It's more cultural and regional and other factors.
But have the actions of the GOP leadership in the Senate and also Iowa's Senator Chuck Grassley as the chair of the Judiciary Committee, have they changed this nomination, advise, and consent process forever?
Well, they've pretty much torn up every other aspect of consensual politics in Washington beginning in the 1990s. And then in the 2000s with the routine use of the filibuster, which was very rarely used before then, you know. I think you can trace this back to Newt Gingrich, who did two things. First of all, he tried to impose British-type parliamentary discipline on an American party, the Republican Party, and that polarized things. And second, beginning with the impeachment of Bill Clinton, you know, there was this idea that we're just going to gum up the works until we get our people into power, which really is a radical break from you know, the I'm not critical of the Republicans for everything, but I do think they've had a rule or ruin attitude ever since Gingrich in the 1990s.
Okay. Thank you very much, Michael Lind. We've come to the end of our half hour with you. Michael Lind is with the nonpartisan think tank New America in Washington, a fellow there, and I believe co-founder as well, right, Michael?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Author of Land of Promises, an Economic History of the United States. Recently, talking most specifically this half hour about an article he wrote recently for Politico, This is What the Future of American Politics Looks Like. Michael Lind, we appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we've come to the end of another edition of River to River. Our program is produced by Lindsay Moon, Claire Roth, and Emily Woodbury, with help from Lauren Knutson. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. If you'd like to suggest a discussion for a future show, you can get in touch with me. You can tweet me at IPRBen. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.